Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quick. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our culture. These pressures can feel overwhelming, and when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to, and that's not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finances, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is attorney Karen Davidson. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I just want to tell our listeners a little bit about your background first. You're a healthcare attorney and the managing member of Law Offices of Karen E. Davidson, LLC. She's been helping physicians strategically negotiate their business arrangements for over 25 years. She's a graduate of Temple University, James Beasley School of Law, and licensed to practice law in Pennsylvania, District of Columbia, and Maine. She represents physicians in virtually all medical specialties and helps them analyze and negotiate all manner of arrangements, including employment agreements. I'm curious about one thing, Karen. How did you get Maine involved in there?
Well, I love the outdoors, and I spend a lot of time, as much time as I can in the outdoors, and Maine is a place that I think for myself will be eventually where I'll be living and, enjoying the beauty.
That's great. So you have, do you have a practice there?
I do not have a practice there per se. I do have some clients that are Maine clients, but basically I'm located in Pennsylvania now.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your business and what you do, because I think it's one of those things that a lot of women maybe don't even think that they have the ability to negotiate a contract, nor do they know where to start. And I think women in all the professions really need to know that someone like you exists so that you can help them to get a better deal. And I think that it's not just that it's a better deal, but from my perspective as a financial advisor, I also know that those pieces of additional compensation that women give up in the early part of their career really makes a big difference over the long term, which how much money they've left on the table. So tell me a little bit about why it is that you got into this particular specialty of law.
Well, I think that harks back to the fact that I was a scientist before I was an attorney. Mm-hmm. And I was in the lab. My undergrad was in biotechnology and science. And so working in the lab, I was involved in hospital environments and dealing with physicians. And then I decided that I did not want to stay in the lab and work with radioactive isotopes for the rest of my life. And I went to law school. Mm-hmm. So healthcare was a way of marrying both my scientific and my connection with medicine with my law practice. And so that's how I basically got into that. And you're right, in terms of my practice and representing physicians, I often find that women have sort of hamstrung themselves from the beginning because they've accepted less compensation or they're willing to accept whatever compensation is, let's say, perhaps initially proposed. And then over the life of their careers, they've been behind the eight ball by those thousands of dollars each year, perhaps. And that certainly adds up over time.
Sure does. And I've often said that it's if most of the employee benefits that women receive are in some way related to a percentage of their compensation, if that percentage, if that compensation, the base level we're dealing with, is significantly less than that of their male peers, then in the long run, as far as 401k contributions, deferred compensation agreements, they lose a significant amount of money because they didn't make as much as their male counterparts. So what are some of the common themes that you find with women physicians when they talk about talk about negotiating? Is it the issue of negotiating, period? Is it that they somehow feel they don't they can't justify the increased amount? What are the issues that they come up with?
Well, I think that for some women, they have a reluctance to ask for more. And so I think through a conversation with me and looking at the survey data that is out there for what the median or the 75th percentile of compensation ought to be, that can help them get a sense of where the offer is on the scale. And so that sometimes gives them a little bit more comfort level to know in the context of what they're asking for.
So where did the survey come from?
The surveys, there are three principal surveys that are out there. One is the Medical Group Management Association survey data, and they survey physicians across the country annually to determine the sort of look at what the physicians are making in different specialties. And when you have access to that survey data, you can drill down even by region. There's two other surveys that are out there for academic medicine and medical group practices. And then some of the hospitals and health systems, if that's where you're going to be employed, they often use that data to make sure that they are basically not exceeding the amount of compensation that they ought to be paying to an individual physician. So they have some regulatory requirements for them. And I would say most women, once I give them either some feedback on the compensation when we're talking about their employment agreement, and get a comfort level with maybe how we can move the needle a little bit to perhaps kind of push the comp in a variety of ways, because physician compensation is such a complex area in and of itself now, much more so than it was even 10 or 15 years ago. So then there is often a comfort level, and some clients of mine will say, hey, you know, please, you go ahead. This is not my strong suit. Please be on the front lines. And then other women just take to it and they go, oh, I'm going back to the chairman and I'm going to ask for, you know, X, Y, or Z. Or maybe they're willing to accept that compensation, but they'd prefer to be on a, you know, a reduced schedule, maybe a 4-day schedule or something like that, or maybe not take quite the level of call. So there's a lot of ways. I would say physician compensation and the entirety of a physician deal or employment arrangement really needs to be looked at together and to come up with a strategy. And that usually happens during the course of my discussions with my clients about what it is, what are their priorities.
What are some of the most unique requests you've ever had to negotiate for some of your clients?
Well, I would say, you know, over time, one or two have related to religious issues. You know, I've had some Orthodox Jewish clients that wanted to get language in their contracts that they were able to take the time off for their religious holidays. I've had, I wouldn't say this is necessarily unique, but I've had clients specifically want to get paid more to take more call for, let's say, OBGYN or perinatologists. and they were, for example, willing to take a little less compensation in some deals because they were actually, the call was less. So that comes up fairly frequently, and I think women, you know, have reluctance to sort of say, oh, gee, if I am doing more than this amount of call, maybe I ought to get paid an extra $2,500 for the weekend because I'm mm-hmm. taking an extra, you know, call or something like that. So it runs in that range. And then there will also be pushback from me if someone comes to me and says, oh, I want to ask for this. And then I'm going to say, look, that's very, very well outside the bell curve. And if there's other things in the contract that are more important to them, then I think sometimes you have to pick your battles. Right. Yeah. You have to pick the things that are important to you. If you ask for the sun and the moon and the stars, you're likely to blow the deal. So there's a balance to be struck. And that's a little bit of an art, not a science. You're trying to get a sense of what the other side will sustain. And then after doing this for so long, I generally have seen, you know, what hospitals or health systems or employers are willing to do. Some are certainly take a more stringent line than others. But that's really a bit of a feel.
Well, you mentioned something to me in a phone call we had earlier about the fact that there is a difference between someone who is employed by a smaller practice versus someone who is employed by one of these larger health system companies as far as their willingness to negotiate directly with the person who would be responsible for employee negotiations. Tell us a little bit about that difference.
Well, often when you have a smaller medical practice, you're going to really be negotiating most likely directly with the managing partner. Okay, so it's four or five or six physicians. The managing partner may take the helm as opposed to handing it off to the attorney. Hospitals or health systems are usually going to have a two-tiered approach. There'll be a contract management person that will be interfacing with the physician. And then once the physician hires legal counsel, then the hospital's attorney may get involved or the health system's attorney. So, and I work at a variety of levels. Depending on what my client's comfort level is. So in some situations, my client and I may decide that it's best for her to be on the front lines to, in a small medical practice, for example, to establish herself as a business person. And then I may also be working simultaneously with the practice's attorney to get the language of the contract right. So I had a DI client not too long ago. And it was exactly this scenario where on the business issues, she was on the front line. She was involved in negotiating how many days a week she was going to work, and she really wanted to have that one day off a week, and she was willing to accept a lesser amount of compensation as a result. She was willing to take equal call. And then we had a lot of language to work through in the contract, and then they referred to their attorney, and then I worked directly with the attorney. So I never had direct contact with any of the other physicians in the practice. And that worked out well because I could get the language, and then I would talk to my client, and then I would say, you know, I think this is a problem here. And then she might go back to the managing partner and say, hey, I thought you all said I could take, you know, one day off a week, and the language doesn't reflect that. How are we going to resolve this? So, and then with hospitals or health systems, I may be dealing with the hospital's attorney, but I always like to keep that back channel open for communication on the business issues. So if we come up with something that is important to the doc, then maybe we're trying to address that through and then have that come up to legal counsel as opposed to legal counsel down. So each situation requires its own strategy. And the parties who are involved and the personalities of the health system itself or the practice itself, and then my client and their comfort level. So there's a lot of, we were talking recently, there's a lot of psychology involved in what I do because there's a lot of thinking and strategizing. And if there's anything that I would convey to people is this is very much of a chess game. So you are you are involved in something that requires the thinking and strategic thinking about it. And I do a lot of that. People come to me, clients come to me during the course of a week for my words. And how do I ask for this? Or how do I say that? And I can give them a phrase or two, and then I send them like Rocky back into the ring. So
that's a good analogy. Kick them back into the ring.
Put them back into the ring.
So do you find that with women, more than with men, you find yourself being the person that is responsible for negotiating the terms of the deal with their employers? Or do you think that it's an even split between men and women?
That's a good question. I would say that it's probably an even split. Mm-hmm. Once my client and I have had the full conversation around the nuances of the arrangement, I would say that I usually try to be very clear with my clients that basically an employment arrangement is going to involve business issues and legal issues. To the extent that they're business issues and they then have a comfort level and they want me to sort of inquire about it or push that agenda, however my client and I discuss it, then I will go off and do that. And that's, and maybe men feel a little bit more comfortable doing that. I do find that there's a reluctance with my women clients to ask for more, and the guys just never question asking for more.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm generally on the lines, all my clients, both men and women, feel more comfortable with me negotiating the legal issues directly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how do people find out what you do? You said to me once before that you have a lot of repeat clients because they're very mobile. They move around a lot. So every time they come to a new employer, they have to negotiate a new contract. But initially, how did you start your practice? How did you start it with that particular specialty?
Well, I do a lot of presentations and have been out there and do a lot of work with young physicians just getting out of residency and fellowship programs. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of speaking there. From my perspective, it's a giving back because I like to educate, you know, young physicians about sort of the field and understanding the business of medicine, which is really its own sort of sub area in healthcare anymore, certainly on the physician side. But, and then a lot of it is word of mouth. So if I've represented physicians graduating from a residency program, and then the next year, you know, people ask around, and then my name is passed along. And then there's that repeat client, as you said, who's traveling around the country, maybe over the course of 4 or 6 or 8 years. I had a client many, many years ago, and I think we've negotiated 4 contracts for her. And she's now, you know, well into her career. She's a perinatologist, you know, for a variety of reasons. She's left the different positions, and we've together, you know, she's been trained by me over the course of time to know what to look for and to know what to be concerned about. And she'll come to me and say, all right, I made sure to ask for, you know, that I was going to get tail coverage. And she's a perinatologist. So, you know, these are a variety of things. And so that really that's how that's grown over time. And then it's just continued to grow in that same way.
That's good. It sounds good. It sounds like you had, there's got to be a passion behind this, that this is a particular specialty. And did it come from the fact that you were in the world of medicine before you started this? Did you see something that spurred you on?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I think if you believe in past lives, I think I was a doctor in a past life. Everybody in my family always comes to me, well, what do you think I should do? I don't feel well or whatever. And of course, I'm not a doctor. I used to tell
them
that.
And you don't play one on
TV. And I don't play one on TV, so, you know, no, okay. I'm not a doctor. But I've always had this affinity for medicine, and I like physicians. Maybe my work, you know, having worked in a hospital environment, the gentleman that I worked for was an MD, PhD. We were doing scientific research on retinoblastoma, and I just enjoyed the interaction with physicians, and maybe that's because I am a scientist also at heart. But so I do have that affinity, and I respect them, and I love the intellectual exchange that I can have with them, and just like I have with my colleagues in the law. But it's a little bit different because I'm able to, what I hope is, translate for them into a very pragmatic, real world way, you know, what they're being faced with various contracts or an arrangement. And so perhaps, hopefully, I've answered your question.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, too, I wanted to ask you about that occurred to me when we were talking about the number of times you've had repeat business from the same client. And I just wonder how many... You mentioned before that there's been a huge difference in physician compensation over the last 10 to 15 years. And in that time frame, I think of women who might be baby boomers who started in medicine when they were part of a practice. And it was a local practice, and it was owned by all the physicians, and someone new walked in, and she was probably given a fairly decent compensation because she was a physician. But then as the practice grew, and then as mergers and acquisitions occurred, and then as the larger hospital systems came in and started buying up all these specialty practices especially, how did that change her approach to who she was originally when she talked to you and who she is and has to be now to be able to get some kind of fair compensation, and with all the issues like discrimination, sexism, whatever you want to call it? We know that that is still there. We've seen information that proves that still within certain specialties, there is a major difference in the compensation between men and women, same number of years experience, same background, same everything. So how does this woman, who's now a baby boomer, go back and look at how she has moved through the system with you and say, maybe it's beyond what I can do? I mean, I think that I understand what it was I was offered when I started, maybe the first time, the second time. But now it's getting to the point where it's so complicated, I don't think I have the skill level to even begin to negotiate this contract, because mostly it's hard for me to even understand it. Do you see that?
Well, what I've seen, for example, is women who are in sort of that more mature stage of their careers, have developed their practice. Now, in the situation, perhaps there's not been as much a discrepancy for them because they've been a part owner of a practice, or they've been able to sort of make their own destiny and garner some of that business side of medicine as a shareholder or a partner in a practice. But I think what happens is then when you get to the complexity of negotiating on becoming an employee, let's say perhaps upon the sale of that practice, then, for example, that's when you, at that switch in careers, you usually come up with that. What I will say is the large medical practices where women were employed and then became owners, usually once you've become an owner, everything's very transparent about what everybody's making, and you can keep an eye on the fact that perhaps your male colleagues are making more than you, but then you can understand the rationale behind that. So maybe, for example, they are more, you or they are more efficient if you're making more money than them, that there shouldn't be necessarily any discrepancies at that point in terms of the formula. The formulas for compensation in the large medical practices, if, say, a smaller practice then joined a large practice, I see that a lot in a variety of specialties. But I would encourage women to not just accept what is, being told, but really look at those formulas, those compensation formulas. And they are complex. But in general, all members or shareholders of a corporation should be treated equally in how the dollars are distributed, or by some formula that allocates on productivity or something like that. So those formulas, again, complexity there, and they should understand those and how it's going to apply to them. Then I had a client recently who had built up her own small family practice, internal medicine, actually, and she was selling to a hospital or health system. And she had at least 5 years left in her career, and she once wanted some very specific things. She wanted her Wednesday mornings off. That was her lifeline. when we first talked about compensation, and she was, again, very involved in the process, but we spent a lot of time talking about what her needs were and how much money she was willing to accept and making sure she was within the bell curve, even though the initial compensation by the hospital or health system was going to put her on a full production. And she was going to have to switch EMRs, and that was going to slow her down. And we didn't want her to be on production for as long as we could keep her on at least some kind of base plus productivity, the base compensation being something that she could really, truly live with and feel good about. So, you know, here she was selling this practice she had built for 20 years. Wow. And that was a big deal for her. So, you know, it was a long process to get there, but ultimately we did. And I will tell you, many times I think she thought she was going to walk from the deal. Wow. She just kept saying, well, they're not willing to do X, Y, or Z. I'm not going to do this. And then we would talk again. And I would say, no, I think we should ask for these two things. And then we slowly, almost issue by issue, worked our way there.
Good. So it's got a happy ending. This is good.
It did have a happy ending. And what was great about that arrangement and what I hear from my clients like her, her words to me were, I feel so safe knowing that you're with me in this process.
That made me feel wonderful
because she could know that someone was looking out for her interests. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have heard that from a number of clients that as we go through it, I had a client recently who was going to take, this is somebody who I've reviewed now two contracts for. She's an emergency medicine physician and was going to move across the country to take a position. And as we started to poke at it, you know, through the agreement and realized that there were some things that they were giving us some discomfort, and we proceeded to do, you know, what we call in the law due diligence, right? Mm-hmm. Expend all efforts to understand who we were negotiating with and what they were willing to do. Is really what I call due diligence, and made some calls, had some conversations. There was a complete unwillingness by the other party to make any of the changes to accommodate my client's concerns. And they were certainly reasonable requests that they, you know, and so she really had pause about the deal, ultimately decided not to take it, even though, of course, she had expended the legal time and the fees to do that. And then 3-4 weeks later came to me with yet another contract that we were going to then negotiate. And during that time when we were talking, she said she had heard through the grapevine that someone else had taken the other deal that she chose not to take and was so unhappy there for exactly the reasons that we had suspected might be problematic. And she just felt so great about that decision. And her comment to me was, there's nothing more worthwhile than having your life. And right. And I know you know, and that was her quote to me. And I just, you know, so that those are the things that's what feeds me is knowing that at the end of the day, I've really helped. And maybe in that way, I'm similar to my physician clients that they know they're helping their patients. And I feel like I'm helping my clients do what they need to do and put them in a better position.
That's, you've mentioned also once before about how devastating it can be to you when people refer to you as an attorney with an expectation that you're going to be so difficult to deal with and so combative and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's not you. That's not who you are, but you do certainly hold your ground. So you want to talk about that for a minute?
Oh, of course. So I'm not a litigator, right? We're not involved in some gladiator type of battle, although I do say I am a paper gladiator sometimes.
Yes.
I mean, I do wage battle with pen, okay? So it's all about the words in what I do. And, of course, approach as well. So I do not feel that being respectful or courteous to the opposing party, whether it be a hospital or a health system or a practice or a third-party insurance company, I don't feel that it is in any way inconsistent with asserting my position on behalf of my client.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at what's important to my client, and we decide on what issues are going to be pursued, and then I recommend things that I think need to be changed, certainly on legal liability issues. So, you know, and again, it is not my personality, and that's why probably I'm not a litigator. And maybe it's the fact that I'm Canadian at heart. So I was born in Canada. Maybe we're just, you know, a little kinder, gentler from the north. But it's not my personality. So I'm there to help my clients. Again, in transactional work, you're generally trying to make a deal with the other side.
Yeah.
And so we're not dealing with a breach of contract action per se. I have helped clients who are trying to get out of an employment arrangement negotiate out of that. But I do find in general that if I want to be dealing with the other side in a respectful and courteous manner. So
that's good. That's good for everybody listening to know that, yeah, it's a good thing. All right. So anyway, I would say that to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, these were invaluable insights and perspectives from attorney Karen Davidson, all of which can help you move your career, your life, your relationships, and financial freedom forward. Karen, how do our listeners get in touch with you?
Well, they can email me at karend@kdavidsonlaw.com, or they can call me. I give my clients my cell phone number, and it is 610-308-7725, and I try to be responsive to folks and get back to them, you know, within a very short period of time. So,
all sounds really good. Karen, thank you so much for being a guest on Power of the Purse podcast, and we'll hopefully have all of you back on the air listening the next time. Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.